Welcome to the Forum from the BBC World Service, where we travel into many worlds, both real and imaginary. Hello, I'm Susan Greenfield, a neuroscientist and professor at Oxford University. But over the next hour, I'll be talking to three guests where we go on a journey that challenges the way we create, communicate, and work. In the studio, we have Indian author and musician Amit Chowdhury, who'll be looking at music lessons in his forthcoming novel to explore the tension between traditional art and changing times and values. Joining us on the line from the BBC studio in Lagos, Nigeria, we have social entrepreneur Ndidi Nwaneli, who also raises questions about tradition, but in a very different light, as she looks at long-held customs and asks whether they're to blame for the culture of corruption in Nigeria. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
But before we look at society, let's start with the individual. Canadian psychologist Steven Pinker is here in the Forum studio. Hi.
Hello.
He's a professor of psychology at Harvard University in the United States. He's well known for his research on language and cognition and has produced a very impressive and exciting series of books. His latest is The Stuff of Thought, where he looks at language as a window into human nature. He explores one way how we can detect how our minds work is through language and the rules that we tacitly obey when we speak languages. Stephen, do you want to explain a little bit about this rather interesting but new idea?
Yes, the idea is that one way to get a picture of how the mind works is to look at what words mean and how people use them. For example, there's a theory of causality that's packed into the way we use verbs. If someone pushes the door open, we say they opened the door. If they open a window and allow a breeze to come in that pushes the door open, we don't say they opened the door even though they caused the door to open. Mm-hmm. We think of causality when we use verbs in terms of a billiard ball clacking into another billiard ball, immediate direct causation. That seems to be, if language is our guide, the most elementary concept of causation that we think in terms of. And it's also the kind of causation that we apply often in assigning moral and legal responsibility. If someone punches someone else, they go to the hospital, and because of a medical error, the person dies on the operating table, we're not sure whether we should hold the first person responsible for murder, even though in a real sense he caused that person's death. Mm-hmm. The same concept of causality that governs how we put words together is the one that we appeal to when we make moral and legal decisions. And that's one of many ways in which the mental model of the world that gets consulted when we use language is the one that seems to govern our affairs when we reason about what to do with our lives. So there's a correspondence between the semantics of language and the mental models that we use to organize our affairs.
Now, we go on from that in your book, and I found this fascinating, not just to talk about who's to blame, but how we can avoid blame and how we can get around difficult situations by playing certain games.
Well, language gives us many ways to talk about a causal event, including ones that omit the causal agent, and politicians are very fond of those constructions, as in mistakes were made, which does not identify who it was that actually made the mistakes. Mm-hmm. Or even in some cases, you can make it seem as if there was no agent whatsoever. For example, the headline, Bus Blows Up. If it refers to a terrorist attack in Israel, for example, where someone strapped explosives, boarded the bus, detonated them, hoping to kill as many Israelis as possible. It's a little bit misleading to describe that event as bus blows up as if it just blew up on its own.
Spontaneously combusted.
Spontaneously combusted. And language allows us to make that distinction between identifying a causal agent, implying that there was a causal agent but leaving it unstated, and implying that something happened spontaneously with no causal agent at all. And by choosing our words, we can frame the same event in those three different ways, mm-hmm. depending on what we want to come to mind in our listeners.
Sure. And of course, one can go beyond those three broad categories to more subtle ones like sarcasm and politeness. And in your book, you explore how you can convey certain meanings with nuances of language.
That's right. In fact, a lot of the language that we use can't be taken literally. If I say to you, if you could pass the coffee, that would be brilliant. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense, taken literally, but you understand it as a polite request. Mm-hmm. If I say, would you like to come up to my apartment and see my etchings? Mm-hmm. You'd probably guess that my intentions might be sexual. Mm-hmm. If I were to say, nice car you got there, it would be a real shame if something happened to it. You might think that I was extorting you. Mm-hmm. Now, why don't people say what they mean? Why do we veil our intentions in innuendo?
And games.
Why do we play games? Mm-hmm. As a scientist, I've assume there must be some hidden rationale, that we're not just doing it to be fancy. And I think there is a hidden rationale. And that is that language has to do two things at once. You've got to get your message across, but you also have to negotiate the kind of social relationship you have with a person. And people are always mindful of what kind of relationship holds between them. Are we friends or relatives where we're intimate and share everything? Is one of us dominant over the other? Are we just business partners who are trading things on a tit-for-tat basis? Language often signals one of those relationships, and it may not be the one that you want to have enforced at that given moment. So let's take an example of a polite request, like passing me the salt. If I just say, give me the salt, it's as if I'm treating you as some kind of underling. It's as if I'm dominant, you're subordinate. I may not want to enforce that relationship. I might barely know you. You might be my boss, but I still want salt. If I say, if you could pass the salt, that would be brilliant, then I do two things at once. I affirm I'm not lording anything over you. I'm not the boss. You're not the subordinate. But I really do want that salt.
And another example you give, and I then want to ask Ndidi's thoughts on this, is bribery. That's a particularly interesting and relevant one to our discussion today. Can you give the example of the bribery hidden innuendo?
For example, this is one that I've studied in experiments. Imagine a scenario where a policeman pulls you over and asks to see your driver's license. You've been speeding, and you show the license with a $50 bill extending ever so slightly. You say, is there any way that we could handle the ticket here without having to go to court and do any paperwork? Which, of course, everyone recognizes as a veiled bribe. And the question is, why do you, if you want to offer a bribe, why don't you just say, hey, if I give you $50, will you let me go without paying a ticket? But I think even in cultures where bribery is endemic, people tell me that there is some form of indirectness, even though it's a charade. Everyone knows what's going on.
Ndidi, is that true, do you think?
Yes, it is. I think that basically nobody wants to be caught red-handed. Mm-hmm. And so being as subtle as possible gives you the out. If you're dealing with someone who doesn't share the same values that you do and will not condone such activity. And you never can tell who is on the receiving end or who is at the giving end, and that's why many people use the subtle language that you've just referred to.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly right. It's what we often call plausible deniability. And I think there's an extra ingredient because, of course, in a culture where the veiled bribe has become routine, it's not as if it's plausibly deniable at all. And any court would say, don't make us laugh. Of course that's a bribe.
Sure.
And I think so there is also a social element. Namely, you don't want to treat the officer with disrespect by implying that he's obligated to let you go in exchange for taking the bribe. You want to pretend to maintain his dominance.
I mean, would the same apply to India as well?
Bribes?
The language of bribes.
I think so. I was just also thinking about, is the only direct kind of unveiled bribe the bribes we make to children, where we say that we will give you this if you do that.
This applies then in different cultures, but I'd be interested to say Stephen was in India and wanted to bribe someone, or if Ndidi came to London. Would this cross cultures, or does each culture have its own set of understanding and assumptions, or is it even more basic and universal than that?
I think each culture has, I mean, there are commonalities, but there are also specific things. But just wanted to ask something.
Please.
I've just read a bit of this chapter you're talking about, the games people play, and found it very interesting, especially because, of things which one recognizes and also, culture-specific things which vary from country to country. Also wondering about other things which also play a part, which are also culture-specific and which are also common between cultures, and things which are not in language, gestures and tones of voice. These things also play very much a part in communicating meaning and certain kinds of meaning, which may be completely contrary to what language is saying, but also culture-specific.
Could you give an example of that?
The funny way Indians are supposed to kind of nod their heads. They're supposed to go from side to side when they say yes, which is not true. There are different ways of saying yes in India. Mm-hmm. There's the nod, as you have in Europe, which is a kind of more clipped kind of thing, maybe obeying orders. Then there's the turn to one side, which shows a more affectionate kind of obedience or agreement.
Right.
And in certain parts of India, southern India, you know, which is a kind of side to side, maybe yes, and possibly.
Yeah. And Didi, is there similar changes in Nigeria as well that wouldn't be immediately understandable in other cultures?
I think that yeah, they are. But you have to remember that just like India, Nigeria has over 350 ethnic groups, and so we have such a diversity. And I don't think that you know I can even point to just three approaches to accepting, you know, to communicating. Mm-hmm. But definitely there's an element of respect, coming back to the bribery issue, where you would actually have to think through, if you put that $50 bill out there, the policeman might actually say, well, it's too little.
Yes, there's that cultural issue as well, isn't there? So, the values.
So there's a gesture thing about how it's given, how it's the tone that's used, but also even the amount that is put forward.
Okay, so going beyond the cultural context then of the monetary value of various bribes and the way we express ourselves, I think we're all agreed that there is certainly covert ways of expressing ourselves. So now turn back to Stephen, because you're an expert on evolution. What would be the evolutionary value in hiding and cloaking our direct requests in this way?
Well, I think the evolutionary roots of these games are the fact that there are, among all organisms, different ways of interacting that have a very different logic. One of them is dominance, where the stronger takes from the weaker. Another is reciprocity, where there's an exchange of benefits that in the long term benefits both of them. And then a third is what biologists call mutualism, sharing as within a family or between two spouses. And we humans are flexible enough to interact with other people in any of those three ways, but it's like a switch that has to be set to one of them. And the games that we play in language are ways of indicating which switch setting is currently in force. Do we have a dominant-subordinate relationship? Do we have a reciprocity relationship? Do we have a mutualistic relationship? And even when you have one of those relationships, to get on with the business of life, sometimes you have to do something that violates it. Even though you might be my boss, I have to respect you. I do want that salt. Mm-hmm. And so how do I boss you around to give me the salt without threatening the fact that you're dominant over me? We play games with language. A sexual overture follows a similar logic. The mere fact that there is sexual interest changes the nature of the relationship. Say in a workplace setting where a superior might solicit sex from a subordinate, as soon as sex is out on the table, they no longer have a standard relationship. How can he or she float the idea of sex without instantly turning the relationship into something that it shouldn't be? Again, you play games with language. You put it in innuendo instead of stating it boldly.
Now, this is a hugely complex task for the human brain to accomplish. And it's not something we're just born with. I don't imagine a six-month-old child or a year-old child would be capable of perceiving and planning and strategizing, even if they could speak. So how do we actually learn how to do this? And are there people who never learn how to do this?
There are. Well, we certainly do have to learn how to use it. And children are. One of the adorable things about children is they often blurt things out that adults would try to state more obliquely. Mm-hmm. And there are people who don't do it. People with autism or even people with Asperger's syndrome who don't have an ability to penetrate other people's minds to anticipate how they will interpret some ambiguous sentence. Here's an example. A friend of mine who had an autistic child called home. The son picked up the phone. He said, is your mother home? And the boy said, yes, and just sat there, not realizing that ordinarily the question, is your mother home, is a indirect request. Can I speak to your mother? Mm-hmm. Can you put her on the phone? But since he took it at face value without thinking ahead as to what the father must have meant by saying that, the communication failed. We ordinarily do that all the time. We have to be intuitive psychologists when we talk. We can't let the literal content of the words carry the message. We always anticipate, how do I expect my listener to interpret what I'm going to say? If you can't do that because that faculty is impaired in autism or Asperger's syndrome, communication will suffer.
Well, that's quite awesome. Although I'm now worried about how I'm going to use the word awesome, but I think here it's literally awesome, and I actually mean that. So a reminder that you're listening to The Forum from the BBC World Service, where we probe beneath the differences to unearth the places in which we connect. So now for a change of gear and a challenge, if you haven't had one already, to get your thinking. How would you change the world in one idea to make it a better place? Well, Ndidi Nwaneli will win us over with her idea. That's me, Susan Greenfield, an Oxford neuroscientist, Indian writer and musician Amit Chowdhury, and Canadian psychologist Steven Pinker. And, of course, you, the BBC World Service audience. Dee Dee, you have 1 minute. Are you ready?
I am.
Okay, go.
I believe in the power of education. I think education is a silver bullet for solving some of the world's largest economic and development challenges. Research has shown by educating women, you reduce the incidence of HIV/AIDS, infant mortality, and ensure better outcomes for children. So my 60-second idea is that in every community in the world, every adult who can read identifies a child in their community and reads to that child for at least 2 hours every week. I believe that reading opens minds, builds knowledge and confidence, enhances curiosity, and most importantly, ignites a passion for and an interest in education. I was a beneficiary of this. My mother read to me every evening, and I read to my children. And I also believe that all of you can adopt children in your community. They don't have to be your children who you can read to. Together, we can ensure that more children are curious enough and want to learn, and that more children get educated. And together, we can solve some of the world's development challenges.
Well done. Absolutely on the bell. Well, I think there's two really interesting strands in your idea. One is the value of reading as opposed to, say, playing with a computer screen. And the other is the greater community and how that greater community can actually be responsible for children. Can I turn to Amit and ask you whether you as an author, how much value you place on reading and the power and value of reading, especially for young people?
For young people, I mean, as an author, as a father with a 9-year-old, with different kind of things competing with reading nowadays, I agree with, this. I think it's an excellent idea. And it's an idea which occurred to the 19th century kind of Indians, reformists, the value of education as a way of tackling colonialism at that time. And then creating this middle class of which we all are the progeny and products in India, the Indian doctors, lawyers, or whoever you see. But also in the so-called developed world, the lack now, even in the academy, of careful reading, especially in literature, of what used to be called close reading.
So what would be the difference between you reading to your child or doing a computer game with your child? Or Googling with your child, or just doing anything on the screen. Why would reading together have more value than, say, working on something on the screen together?
I think there's a lot to be said for the kind of visual culture that's going on around us right now. But reading is one has to slip into cliche and maybe into one's own prejudices. But reading seems to be less passive. You're making something of the world in the book. The computer seems to make you a bit more passive. Again, I might be wrong about that.
Well, I turn now to our language expert. I'm sure, Stephen, you've got some thoughts on the value of reading rather than the screen.
Well, I couldn't agree more that reading brings enormous benefits. Although it does make you think whether having a story read to you or Googling, at least as long as you're not Googling just for images, but if you are reading what comes up on the screen, satisfying your curiosity by following links, pursuing a topic in greater depth, I wonder if it would be any worse. It is reading. We shouldn't be prejudiced whether the text is on wood pulp or on an LCD screen. And it's an open question whether children would be better served by the indeed very active process of pursuing information on the web, as long as they're not just using it to surf for porn or action heroes.
Yeah, indeed. I think the reason this...
Come back in.
Yes, please. Yes, because it really strikes a chord.
I definitely think that, especially in the developing world, reading is more compelling, primarily because computers, first of all, people can't access computers. There's not a lot of electricity. And under any tree in any village, you can pick up a book, even in that language, and read to a child. Now, also assume that this can start at a very young age, from as early as 1 year or even 6 months old, getting a child interested and engaging the child in the discussion about the book. It's amazing the curiosity it breeds and also the level of imagination. I mean, after reading to a child, a week later, the child might come back with an idea about the book and a question about what they read. So obviously, there can be an argument about what choice of material you use. But my belief is that this type of idea can be applied in every single community, whether they have electricity or whether they have computers or not. Mm-hmm. And even for adults who can read and who have computers, I think that computers have made us relatively lazy. Speaking from myself, even with spelling, I'm so amazed at how poor we spell now just because we have spell checkers, and how easily it is to forget words. And I'm learning a language now because I'm spending a lot of time in Francophone Africa, and there's freetranslation.com, so all I have to do is plug in my English and it converts it to French. And I don't even have to bother. So, I mean, it just, there's a lot of benefit and wealth of information on the internet, but I think it doesn't challenge our minds as much as reading does.
Yeah, someone has said there's a distinction between information and knowledge, and that you might be able to have lots of information, but... Can I ask you again this notion of the community? Because above and beyond the values of reading, and I think we're all agreed here that it gives you something the screen doesn't give you. What prompted you to suggest this as a cure to the problems of children in the community? Because here in the UK, we're worried about the breakup of the nuclear family and the impact it has on so-called feral children now. But do you see that as a problem worldwide?
It definitely is a problem worldwide, and I think one of the things that we still hold very dear to on the African continent is the core concept of the community and how it takes a community to raise a child. And I think more and more, even in the developed world, you're seeing the benefit of buddy systems and mentoring programs and big sister and big brother programs, because there are a lot of children who, either because their parents have passed away or are too busy to be with them, still need parenting and still need attention. And adults, whether they're that related or not, are becoming that surrogate parent. And I think we need to encourage more of that community feel, that every single person owes a duty to ensure that a child has a better life, whether it's their child or someone else's child.
Well, I think it's a wonderful idea because, as you say, it's cheap to implement, and it's everyone wins, the community and the givers as well as the children. Stephen, what's your thinking?
The only shortcoming I see with this plan is how would you implement it? You couldn't have storybook police that would force a person to read to someone else's child. Mm-hmm. What you ideally would want, but there's no magic formula for getting this, is that people would spontaneously do it in order to be accepted members of their community. Yeah. And the great challenge is the kind of cultural changes that just happen by accident. A generation of teenagers gets tattooed or gets their bodies pierced in the West. Mm-hmm. No one implemented that as a policy. It spreads like wildfire by processes that we can't control as social engineers. Is there some way to tip or bias the process so things happen spontaneously in a culture without having to be enforced?
Well, I think the idea of the book police is quite interesting. I'm wondering what kind of uniform they'd wear, the book police. But you heard it here first, and let's say the idea's been launched here, so let's hope that now people will set spontaneously and train this wonderful idea of indigenous. Thank you very much. But we'd also like to know what you, the BBC listeners, think. Do listen again on our website and let us know. You'll find the forum at bbcworldservice.com, or drop us an email, theforum, that's one word, at bbc.co.uk. And don't go away. It's time to pause for a minute, but we'll be back with more after this.
BBC. Day by day, athletes across the world prepare for their Olympic moment. Hour by hour, people everywhere get ready to cheer them on to glory. Minute by minute, the protests continue.
Monks in hundreds and hundreds have been arrested in midnight raids and have been taken away to undisclosed locations.
In the countdown to the Beijing Games, the BBC looks at whether China can clean up its human rights record in time for the opening of the Olympics.
There's great unrest all over the country, and so they've decided to crack down. They've decided that the Olympics could actually be a risk for them.
Countdown to the Olympics starts Wednesday, the 2nd of July, on the BBC World Service.
If English isn't your first language, you might want to check the news in a different one. We report global and regional news in 33 languages at bbcworldservice.com.
Coming up on the forum from the BBC World Service, Indian author and musician Amit Chowdhury asks, what does it mean to be an artist? Canadian psychologist Steven Pinker guides us through linguistic minefields. And from Nigeria, social entrepreneur Ndidi Nwaneli calls to change the rules of business in Africa. We'll be back after the news.
BBC News with Jerry Smith. President Bush, who's visiting Britain today, has warned against any definite timetable for the withdrawal of troops from Iraq. In an interview with a British newspaper, Mr. Bush says any pullout must be based only on success, and a premature withdrawal could jeopardise the gains made in Iraq. The Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, has warned that he's ready to send troops across the border into Pakistan to confront militants based there. President Karzai said that when militants came over the frontier from Pakistani territory and killed Afghans, his country had the right to retaliate in self-defense. Security forces in Afghanistan, hunting for hundreds of militants who escaped from jail in the southern city of Kandahar, have killed 15 insurgents. Reports say they were shot dead at a farm compound in Kandahar province. Another five suspects were taken into custody. 3 months after declaring independence from Serbia, Kosovo is beginning self-rule. The constitution, which has just come into force, sees no role for the United Nations in running Kosovo. Instead, the European Union is to send several missions. It's not clear who will oversee the Serb-dominated areas. Macedonia is holding a partial rerun of parliamentary elections in areas in which voting 2 weeks ago was marred by violence and intimidation. About 10% of the electorate will get a second chance to vote. Torrential rain and floods across southern China has killed 55 people and forced more than a million to flee their homes. Nine provinces have been affected, including Sichuan, which was devastated by last month's earthquake. Japanese rescuers digging through mud and debris after Saturday's earthquake have found three more bodies, bringing the total of known deaths to nine. They were among several people feared buried by a landslide that crashed onto a hotel. BBC News.
This is The Forum from the BBC World Service, where we bring together a heady mix of international thinkers to challenge convention. I'm neuroscientist Susan Greenfield, and coming up in the next half hour, The Songs of India with an author and musician, Amit Chaudhuri, the artist in modern times. Also, Canadian professor of psychology, Steven Pinker from Harvard University in the USA, who reveals a greater understanding about the way we speak. But first, Nigerian social entrepreneur Ndidi Nwaneli, who is the managing partner of Ace Consultants and the founder of Leap Africa, which promotes good business practice and entrepreneurship across Africa and specifically in Nigeria. Ndidi has worked as a consultant for the World Bank and the Ford Foundation, amongst many others. She's currently writing a book in progress called Building a Culture of Ethics in Nigerian Companies. She speaks in the book of a lack of monitoring institution and transparency as major contributing factors to corruption, but also pinpoints in Nigerian culture the practices that perhaps also facilitate that culture of corruption. Ndidi, perhaps you could amplify this point a little bit.
Basically, I believe that Nigerian culture and African culture more broadly does not condone corruption and does not explicitly support corruption. And historically, cultures, shunned theft and lies and cheating and punished members of their societies who embarked on these type of corrupt or unethical dealings. But today, as we examine our society, we see aspects of our culture that actually promote corruption. One of them is the whole concept of your brother. Who is your brother? Who is your sister? And the fact that as you move up in society, the number of brothers and sisters you have increases because there are no social safety nets, and you are responsible for supporting those in your family, those in your community, and those who know you. And that you're often considered selfish if you don't share with others. This puts tremendous pressure on individuals who either achieve any element of success or level of success in the private or public sector, because they often have to provide for 20 or more families and stretch their own salaries to provide for these people. Invariably, it forces them to start cutting corners or looking for creative ways within their positions to source additional funds. And beyond the whole concept of brother or sister, the other concept, aspect of our culture that promotes corruption, I think, is our short-term focus, which has not always been part of African culture, but with the military rule and the dictatorship that Nigeria and other countries have faced, people have learned to live in the present, and they basically don't think about the future. Grab all you can now, because you don't know if you'll still have your position in the future. And then the third aspect, forgiveness and second chances. It fascinates me that I can fire an employee today, and tomorrow they come to ask me for a recommendation. And if I fired them for, you know, unethical dealings, they still think they can come and ask for a recommendation the next day. And this is primarily tied to the view that, hey, you can forgive people, give them a second chance. And we give so many second chances in our society, and that's why we see some of the same old corrupt people who have been, you know, fired in the public or private sector coming back for new positions and reinventing themselves continuously.
But these are very deeply entrenched issues that you're raising, culture, mm-hmm. the transient environment, a spirit of forgiveness, right. and so on. How could you ever change someone's mindset from such strongly held and understandable issues?
Well, I think that addressing the issue of corruption requires a strong institution where people are punished and exposed, and that this is not a transient thing where they're punished and put away for 6 months, but that there's, you know, that information is free and disseminated, where there's a strong press that's ethical as well, because these are prerequisites for changing mindsets. But what people tell me after my programs is, hey, Ndidi, I leave very challenged and inspired, and I have a new moral code and a compass, and I'm ready to live ethically, but I live in an unethical environment. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, let's turn to the aforesaid professor of psychology sitting next to me. Well, I'm sure he has an interpretation from his stance.
Yes, I think it's a brilliant analysis, and but I think it goes beyond Nigerian society. I think it highlights the clash between basically the natural way that humans run society since time immemorial and the institutions of modernity, which in many ways go against human nature. I think it is human nature to favor your blood relatives and your close friends. And indeed, a modern institution like a democratic government or a corporation or a university forces us to inhibit very strong social impulses. If you have a position to offer, it's natural to think, well, what kind of heartless cad would give it to a perfect stranger over his own brother? Mm-hmm. And the fact that the perfect stranger is more qualified, we sort of see as a mere technicality. Mm-hmm. Likewise, the idea of being loyal to a society like your nation state over your own clan mm-hmm. is something that doesn't come naturally.
And, I mean, you're nodding there. India has a strong tradition of honoring family ties. How far are cultural norms transferred into the world of business in India?
I don't know that much about the world of business, but I can speak about the world of the intelligence here, the academy, and certainly there's a kind of family romance going on over there with certain people who are favored or, you know, and also certain hierarchies in place. I mean, there are family romances of hierarchies and favored sons taking place.
Mm-hmm. So can you amplify a little bit what you mean by a hierarchy and favored son?
You have the elder brother, the idea of the elder brother. In Bengali, the word is dada, mm-hmm. you know. And now this in secular India also gets translated into other relationships. And so that you will sometimes hear in left-wing liberal or left-wing mm-hmm. circles, high intelligentsia, high academy, the word dada being used of somebody who's a teacher mm-hmm. or a senior colleague.
Indeed, is it the same in Nigeria? Would you have a similar elder brother relationship as well as just a brother relationship?
Well, I think there's definitely a lot of respect for older people, and that translates into the ability, the fear of challenging them or revealing their inconsistencies. And we see that repeatedly. Also, we have an issue around godfatherism. We call it godfatherism and maybe godmotherism, where individuals adopt some big man in society to protect them and to ease their way into the mm-hmm. system and to ensure that they can succeed in spite of unethical behavior or with unethical behavior. But I think, you know, with all the comments, there's definitely a need for our societies and our companies to move towards, you know, an ethical framework. And there are aspects of our culture that we want to hold on to, but there are other aspects that we have to be willing to let go of.
Because some of the issues you're raising are actually desirable. Surely it's good to be loyal to your family. It's good to look after your brother. So how can you be flexible enough to know when to apply those rules and when not to apply those rules?
in a company setting, for example, the company has to have its own set of rules. And you have to have two personalities, meaning when you're at work, your loyalty is to the company. When you're at home, your loyalty is to your family. And the company provides enough, hopefully, salary for you to take care of your family. But that there has to be a separation. Similarly, in public office, there has to be a separation. And that's what people struggle with, is realizing that, you know, each of these institutions has to have its own code of conduct that clearly spells out what behaviors are expected, and that those behaviors are either rewarded or punished if they are not adhered to. There's an important role for the board of directors in every company, for the CEO to model behavior, and for the staff to imbibe that culture. And if that culture is not adhered to, then, you know, there should not be a place for that employee within an organization. And I think that that's the tension that we're facing, is that as we're evolving from, you know, family-owned businesses or one-man businesses to companies that are listed on a stock exchange, mm-hmm. that same transition has to occur, where the company doesn't revolve around the individual who started it and his or her own, you know, whimsical behavior, but revolves around codes of conduct and behavior.
Mm-hmm. So this transparency and standardized way of setting about things, of course, was already transcended back from the professional world into our personal lives with prenuptial agreements before we get married and so on. I think, Stephen, you have some thoughts about the tacit agreements that we make between each other, not just professionally but personally.
Yeah, well, it's another illustration of the enormous chasm between the way we organize our social lives and our everyday life, what human nature predisposes us to do, and the formal arrangements by which we run a complex democratic society, and the temptation towards cronyism and nepotism and hierarchy that get in the way of modern institutions like governments and corporations. And they also affect us in our personal lives, such as the advice that all lawyers give when a couple gets together and plans to get married, that they should sign a prenuptial contract, how the property would be divided in case they eventually get divorced. This would save an enormous amount of expense and trouble and emotional pain down the line if the couple gets divorced, as about 50% of couples do in the United States. Nonetheless, many couples resist this suggestion, and they're not being completely irrational, because it's in the very nature of an intimate relationship, like a marriage, that you don't explicitly negotiate the terms of the contract. You don't say, here's how our love affair is going to go. If you get in trouble, I'll help you. If I get in trouble, you'll help me. We'll have sex so many times a week. We'll be affectionate. Mm-hmm. You don't do it that way. You either feel it in your bones or you don't. And that's a difference between intimate relationships like friendships and family relationships and romantic relationships, and formal ones in corporations mm-hmm. and societies. And in fact, a prenuptial contract can also make itself be needed, because the more you think through what should we put into our prenuptial agreement, the more you're saying, I'm thinking about getting divorced. I'm thinking about the terms of our relationship. And by putting it on paper, you actually threaten the emotions that actually will keep you together. It's another illustration of the clash between our instinctive social ties and the ones that we put on paper in institutions.
So clearly this is a worldwide and I think very wide-ranging issue, this disconnect that indeed is highlighted between social values, social behaviours, social norms and professional ones. And clearly, we need some sort of cultural change to try and regulate how we make transitions from one back to the other again. First, let me remind you that you're listening to The Forum from the BBC World Service. Now, traditional arts and survival of the artist, in our minds and in the real world, by Indian author and musician Amit Chowdhury. His latest novel is called The Immortals, and it's going to be published next spring. But we've had a preview. It concerns the interaction between two central characters, a music teacher, Shyam Lal, and his affluent student, Nimalia Singhgupta, who is at the time of the novel opening 16 years old. The teacher aspires to material allure of Bombay's 1980s, now Mumbai, and is travelling in the opposite direction to his student, who rejects the materialism and is rather romantic in espousing the high art of the music, the raga. And really the novel's about the tension between the different visions of the world as each of these two protagonists travel in their opposite directions.
As Nirmala began to shed the meanings he'd grown up with, he busily assigned new ones. He fell almost belligerently in love with an idea to do with an immemorial sense of his country, and music was indispensable to it. The raga contained the land within it, its seasons, its times of day, its bird call, its cloud and heat. It gave him an ideal magical sense of the country. It was a fiction he fell in love with. Having subscribed to the fiction, everything else was a corruption or aberration. The Marine Drive, Thacker Towers, the company his father ran, tea at the Taj Mahal Hotel, nothing was true enough.
Amit, the music teacher in your book will later tell his critic, Baba, you can't fill your stomach with classical music. This issue of abstract cultural values versus more pressing material ones, would you say this is the central theme of your book?
Yeah. Now, ever since the late 90s, you feel that something new has happened to the writer or to the artist and to their relationship to the market via publishing or whatever. Something has changed. I felt that something changed around the mid-90s. And on a crude, visible level, it had to do with the way the writing was marketed as well as the writer. And, you know, who the writer was, what writing is about, what is popular culture, what is serious culture. Anyway, all those things were, all those bastions of culture, etc., were falling apart in the 70s and 80s from various directions. The market, you know, movements in philosophy, which were bringing down the idea of high culture in the West. From there emerged new but not completely articulated ideas of where the writer was now. And the writer was now either upbeat, as most writers were supposed to be, or in a state of anxiety. And I wanted to record this by looking at something earlier.
So would you say you're in a state of anxiety now, or are you upbeat?
I'm in a state of anxiety, and I feel to be in a state of anxiety is to be anomalous in the post-globalization world, which is an upbeat world.
It's a democratic world.
It's a democratic world. Great. It's also an upbeat world. Modernity was also a democratic world, but philosophically or culturally speaking, it was not incompatible with expressions of failure and anxiety. So a lot of modernism, in fact, in various parts of the world, not just Europe, is made up of dealing with failure, and failure in one's life, but also failure as a mode of approaching the artwork, which is why the fragmentary was such an important constituent of modernist art. Both the fragment has disappeared, as well as, you know, this sense of belatedness, not being at home with globalization, I feel. This has a good side to it, but it also has other sides to it. We have stopped thinking about failure, daydreaming, opting out as serious contenders in the way our cultural life is shaped.
So what are we thinking about instead if we've stopped thinking
about
thinking
about success.
So in a sense, we have the same problems we've just been discussing, which is where there's no obvious good or bad, but there is a disconnect between two different ways to travel. How do you think that's changed the way the democratized world, we, the consumer, sees the artist? Do we see them as gurus? Do we see them as different and special? Or do we see them as just like us?
Yeah, but that's the other thing that I was kind of exploring in this novel. Let's say, in the 19th century or thereabouts in Europe, novels were produced about, in effect, the ordinary reader. The reader went to the novel to consume his own life and went to the film for the same reason. And that kind of cultural shift or movement which created that reciprocity or whatever it was, relationship, that lasted for about 100 years or more. Now, in the 80s, something began to change. And you see that with, firstly, with trivial things like karaoke, with pop idol, with the various talent competitions you have. But I saw it in Bombay in a different way, where the rich were actually buying time on the stage. They were turning themselves through money into being singers, and they were owning their teachers in a sense. Now, what was happening here is the shift from the ordinary person wants to see himself in a work of art. Now, the ordinary person actually wants to occupy, even if it's for 15 minutes, the place of the artist.
The famous for 15 minutes.
Famous, but given a new news interpretation, as a new cultural movement, actually, not just in just being a celebrity, to occupy the place of the artist. It is possible. It is possible. There's this wonderful writer, Dubravka Ugresic, Croatian, who writes about the fact that, you know, Ivana Trump was a skier, then she married a millionaire, then she wrote a novel. You know, it is possible for the skier to write the novel.
but it is not possible for the novel to become a skier. Now, what does the novelist, the ontological, the person mm-hmm. ontologically formed writer as of romantic times, I was born a writer, what do? They can't become runners or skiers or athletes, but the athletes can make, and they're doing it all the time.
The reason I'm smiling is it actually resonates a little bit with me as a scientist, because since the 1980s, we've talked about the democratization of science, and I don't know if Stephen agrees with me, but we scientists like to think that we have a higher calling and that we're very purists and have access to a special way of seeing the world. But on the other hand, I think, Stephen, you'd agree, I think we both share the same ideas that we feel we have to democratize science and share it with everyone else. Wouldn't you? Do you see parallels yourself between what Amit's just been saying about art and the issues and the disconnect and the sort of conundrum that this is posing, and indeed what it's posing for us as 21st century scientists?
Yes, I think there's a difference between the democratization of science and arts. With the arts, there is a place for an open marketplace of many different genres that appeal to very many different segments of the population. With science, I think you and I share the idea that there is an imperative to share our best science, to make it as accessible and as comprehensible to as many people as possible, although there can't be many sciences there. We, believing that there's an objective reality and that science is trying to characterize it, really believe that there is ultimately one science. The work itself has to stand up to scientific standards. We don't want astrology and crystal healing and so on as alternative sciences out there. That having been said, assuming that the quality remains constant, we certainly want the ideas to be disseminated as widely as possible.
And Didi, what's your view on artists as a businesswoman, as coming from the commercial world? Do you think that artists can have a value above and beyond helping create money and have status themselves? Do you think they actually bring something to the party that would otherwise be missing?
Well, I listening to the comments, there's definitely a value judgment being placed on quality, and I think that that's open for debate. But I think that, especially in, from my environment, what we're seeing is an explosion of our entertainment industry in terms of writers, singers, actors and actresses, the evolution of an industry we're calling Nollywood. And from one perspective, it's very exciting because these are industries that are emerging in spite of the government and in spite of the challenges to starting businesses and growing businesses. And for the first time, everyone believes that they can be an artist and that it's not reserved for, you know, the intellectuals, and it's within their grasp. Now, that cheapens it a little. It might reduce the quality of the, you know, of the output, but I still feel like from a business perspective, it's exciting because it's giving people a way out and allowing them to discover aspects of themselves that were not celebrated before. I mean, to be, if you ever told your parent that you're going to be a writer or a singer 20 years ago, they would have thought they had failed. They wanted you to be a doctor or an engineer. Yeah. But today, it's being celebrated because they're earning a living, and they're making money. And so I can share the fears of you know, intellectuals who celebrate, you know, high art. But I also think that there is a place from an economic perspective for art that's appealing to the masses. That, and so maybe there is a need for a distinction about what is high art and cheap art or mass market. But from my perspective in Nigeria, I mean, Nollywood and what it has produced, and our writing industry and our fashion industry and our music industry is booming, and I'm so excited about it. It's a bright spot in our history at the moment.
Yeah, but perhaps also another great bonus of creativity as well as wealth creation is that this is really the ultimate expression of one's individual identity. And that's something, again, I mean, that you touch on with the notion of authorship, and that's another key theme in your book. Not just who is the author, but when there's no author, when there's anonymity. And I think one of the issues you raise with the classic Indian ragas, which is the form of music that is the purest form and the oldest form, and that promoted by our hero, is suggesting that the whole appeal of it is the very anonymity of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is something that, you know, I came to Indian music when I was about 16 years old, began to learn it seriously. And before that, you know, I'd grown up in Bombay with Western popular music, especially American popular music. And with ideas about composers from Western classical music as well. And the notion of the author is very important and has traditionally been very important to Western high culture. I had to now contend with a culture which had no Bachs or Beethovens, mm-hmm. you know, and where the raga, I mean, when no one knew who had composed the raga itself was not a composition. It was a mode, almost, brought to life each time by the performer within strict rules and within complicated, complex genres.
Stephen, as a writer yourself, how important is it to you that it's Steven Pinker yes. that's written the book, or is it just that the ideas should be there? And this goes back to your idea of causality and verbs. Should we say the idea has been produced, or should we say Steven Pinker's produced the idea? How important is it to you, this ownership?
It's a profound issue because no one can create a work of art or a work of science out of the blue. We always recombine other ideas that are out there that we give credit to various extents. We put our own spin on it by assembling it in a brand new combination. But it's a concept that our intellectual property laws and our traditions of authorship have not properly come to grips with. Every word in the English language was coined with someone, but I don't have to go back and pay a royalty to the first person who used the word exciting. Likewise, in technology, if you had to track down the person, the heirs of the person who invented the wheel to send them a portion of the profits, then technology would break down. With digital technologies that make it easier to copy and to sample and, as kids say, to mash up, our laws, which always have to identify an author and send them a royalty check, are going to start to get in the way of the creative process.
Ndidi, what's your thoughts on the creative process in commerce? Do you feel that it's important that someone owns an idea or suggests something, or is it more important to work as a corporate, as a collective, to do whatever you need to do?
Well, I'm a social entrepreneur, so I'm caught between two worlds. My social entrepreneur hat, looking at something like HIV/AIDS drugs, says we need a collective. But from a business perspective, clearly there's a role for patents, and there's a role for trademarks, and there's a need to assign ownership, because otherwise companies will not invest the R&D required because they want to make the profits. So it's a difficult and tricky situation. And because I wear two hats, I'm somewhere down the middle.
Well, sadly, we're running out of time, and I've got to draw this fascinating and many disparate threads to a conclusion. It seems to me that we've been caught between two worlds, if not many worlds, between the worlds of the family and the values there and professionalism, between the worlds of high art and pure culture with the needs of the democratized society, and between the needs of the individual and the needs of the person you're negotiating with, whether you want them to see your etchings or give them a bribe. I think one thing that we have agreed on, though, is that in this global world, a world dominated by the web, there's still a need for reading and working as a collective with our children. So there are actually various ways in which we can see a way forward, despite the fact we're caught between two worlds, and that's, I think, to foster communication across it. Well, that's all we have time for this week. So many thanks to my three guests, Canadian psychologist Steven Pinker, Indian novelist and musician Amit Chowdhury, and Nigerian social entrepreneur Ndidi Nwaneli. But don't forget, you can listen again to the forum by going to bbcworldservice.com. And if you'd like to let us know what you think, do contact us by emailing the forum, that's all one word, at bbc.co.uk. Next week, philosopher Angie Hobbs will be here hosting our thinkers. She'll be talking to geologist Jan Jalashevitz and historian Mark Mazawa from Columbia University in New York. So from me, Susan Greenfield, have a good week.
You could never tell, really, do these people like me for what I am?
This man can legally own a house in the same street as this woman.
They beat me and they kicked me, and I'm afraid to say they called me a white bitch the whole time.
But would he? The BBC talks to South Africans about what it's like to live in the Rainbow Nation. Race and Reconciliation, the Monday documentary, at 11, 14 and 21 CET on the BBC World Service.